I'm Gabe Ortiz, afternoon host at WIPR. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make the live streams like this one more difficult to maintain. Stand up for public media and help fortify WIPR's future. Find out more and donate at WIPR.org. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Today it's midday on sports. Let's talk a little Orioles baseball, maybe some Ravens football. The NBA finals begin Thursday night. The WNBA held a game at CFG Bank Arena that was Caitlin Clarkless, but enthusiasm for the league clearly still very high. So what do you think is at the heart of what the O's need to do to turn things around this year? And how do you feel about the decision by the Ravens to punt Justin Tucker before a league report looking into accusations of inappropriate behavior is released? The future Hall of Famer denies those allegations. WIPR's afternoon host and sports aficionado Gabe Ortiz joins me in Studio B. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday at WIPR. Gabe, good to see you.
Nowhere else I'd rather be.
There you go. And let's start today with the Ravens. After a disappointing end to last season, the offseason has been tumultuous. Kyle Goon, a sports columnist for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, joins us from the Ravens practice facility in Owings Mills. Kyle, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tom.
So what do you make of the Ravens' decision to terminate the contract with Justin Tucker before the NFL publishes its findings in its investigation and, you know, the characterization by the team of it being a football decision?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of word dressing on something that I think everyone understands why the Ravens let Justin Tucker go. And I think they have to anticipate, you know, whenever the NFL investigation does conclude and you know, hand down discipline, that Justin is going to miss, you know, perhaps the start of the season, maybe the whole season. The only sort of precedent is Deshaun Watson. When he played for the Browns, he was suspended for 11 games. It's a complicated process, but the Ravens drafted a kicker, Tyler Loop from Arizona, and they kind of decided, you know what, we don't need to deal with the uncertainty. We don't need to wait for the sort of Damocles to drop. We can just go ahead with this young guy that we like and let Justin Tucker go. So I think it's pretty clear why they did it, just sort of in the event of a suspension or otherwise for Justin, and they can kind of move on and go with their young guy now.
Hey, Kyle, Gabe Ortiz here. I'm just curious, you know, when they say that it's a football decision, I think we need to acknowledge that last season, Justin Tucker missed one field goal against Las Vegas in a game they lost by three. He missed two field goals in Pittsburgh in a game they lost by 2 points. He left 7 points on the field against Philadelphia in Baltimore in a game they lost by 5 points, in addition to missing field goals in games against Kansas City and Cleveland, which wouldn't have decided the game, but certainly would have helped. I think there are very legitimate football reasons to have this conversation. And is it fair to say that this team has too much investment, too much talent, too good of a quarterback to be losing decisive games because of a place kicker? And even if these allegations didn't exist, at 35 years old and coming off his career worst season, being one of the lower half kickers in the NFL in 2024, would these conversations about moving on from Justin Tucker been nearly, if not just as real without the allegations?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the Ravens would have brought in competition, and you know, there is precedent for that. And I believe it was 2012 or 2011 they brought in Justin. They brought in Justin as an undrafted free agent to compete with Billy Cundiff, a competition that he won. But I mean, if you kind of check the language between the end of the season last year and Justin ended the season on a very strong note, and was pretty reliable toward the end of the year. And then, you know, to now, I mean, a lot has changed in the tone. I mean, I think John Harbaugh and the collective, you know, Ravens brass were very trusting that Justin could get back to his old self and that sort of the end of the season performance was more reflective of the kicker they knew. I mean, this is a guy with a great track record. Kickers in the NFL go well into their 40s. And, you know, it's just not, you know, an over the hill type position for a 34, 35 year old. So I think the tone of everything kind of changed after the allegations came out. I think he would have had competition and he would have had to protect his job. But ultimately, I think everyone understands that the ultimate factor in this decision is Justin's availability stemming from this NFL investigation.
410-662-8780. If you want to chime in, our email midday@wipr.org. Let's listen to some remarks Eric DaCosta made. He's the Ravens general manager. These are remarks he made at the Combine in Indianapolis on February 25th. So that's about a month after the Banner published the first articles about the allegations made by various massage therapists against Justin Tucker. Here's what Eric DaCosta had to say at that time.
So we were aware that a local media outlet was getting prepared to do a story on Justin Tucker. That was the first time that we became aware of those allegations or the potential allegations that might result. I did meet with Justin. I'm going to keep those comments to myself.
How does that play into your deliberations on this?
Well, I think, again, it's a good question. I think the biggest thing that we have to do, first of all, is look at every single case differently. There are no absolutes. And I think in this case, we're still awaiting as much information as possible. We'll wait for the details of that investigation and we'll make a decision based on that.
And Kyle, you wrote right after the Banner published those stories that this will be a test for the Ravens, who have boasted in the past of a zero-tolerance policy that has in practice been conveniently vague and open to case-by-case interpretation. This is what exactly what Eric DaCosta is talking about. It's a test for the NFL, which has consistently underwhelmed in long investigations that rarely dole out severe consequences. What's at stake for the league, and what's at stake for the team, in your view, at this juncture here?
Well, I mean, I think it's as simple as, do we stand up for our player, and do we stand up for our community? I mean, these allegations are widespread over many years and alleged that Justin Tucker violated, some at the very least, a sense of personal decency for over a dozen members in our community. And I think it's disillusioning for fans of football, certainly women fans of football who have really been a growing market in the NFL in the last few decades. And I just think every one of these issues is sort of its own moral test of, do we stand for, these players and try to put a great product, or do we stand for the fans and the people who buy the tickets and watch the games and cheer on the teams? And I think it's a tough process for a lot of fans looking at their memories and kind of thinking about, all the joy that Justin Tucker brought them over the years and kind of wondering, how that person could be the person that had some of these really tough situations kind of hidden away for so long. So I just think there's a lot at stake for the Ravens and the NFL in terms of building trust with the fan base and showing that, they have sort of a character obligation, especially when it comes to, people in the community potentially being violated.
And I know we do need to let you go. You're up at Owings Mills at the OTAs, which are the organized team activities. But before you go, has the NFL kind of evolved over the years when it comes to, players getting in situations of these allegations? Sometimes they're even on tape with Ray Rice. We have Ray Lewis, his problems when he was playing. Are they handling this differently in any substantial way than they handled things, in years past?
The Ray Rice situation was so unique because, frankly, the Ravens covered for Ray for a long time before the video was finally released and sort of had to relinquish. I mean, obviously, that situation has not been handled the same with Justin, and they've released him. But I just think the NFL in general obscures a lot of this process. I mean, there is an investigation ongoing. The likelihood is we'll never read any report or results of the investigation. When this all came out, Justin Tucker went on record and called us at the Banner liars and tabloid fodder. And I think it would be somewhat validating to hear from the NFL on what they found and if their investigation supports what the Banner found in their investigation. But I don't think that the NFL is ever going to release an actual paper report. And I just think that speaks to the lack of transparency that's very convenient for that league and perhaps inconvenient for the fans of the league.
Kyle Goons, a sports columnist for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, which broke that story back in January. Thanks, Kyle. I appreciate it. We will be in touch.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
So, Gabe, it is interesting that we've got these allegations and then Justin Tucker's reaction. What do you make of that? Because his initial reaction, as Kyle just said, you know, the Banner is liars, it's tabloid. Then a little bit later, he started saying, you know, if I've been inappropriate with anybody or if I've hurt anybody's feelings, I'm sorry. We haven't heard a lot from Justin Tucker. Will Justin Tucker get picked up by another team? What do you think?
I think a lot of that depends on what the results of this investigation are. And to Kyle's point, if any of that actually gets released to the public, or if it's just we concluded our investigation and we found no wrongdoing, as something we hear a lot as fans whenever things like this pop up, or if there's actually some substance behind it. And the NFL says we did find empirical evidence of wrongdoing by Justin Tucker. And, you know, the world and the league is not the same as it was in the 90s and the early 2000s. And I think teams will go in with a mindset of how will this fall back on us? How will we look after picking up a player if this investigation comes out not looking very good for Justin? So it's hard to predict because the pendulum could swing so far in either direction depending on what the NFL has to say. But I do think that the Ravens deciding to move on from him was a pretty big indictment in of itself. And I also think that it is a moment in time here of, you know, the consciousness, the social consciousness that NFL teams, franchises, staffs, and leadership have around these things. I think in years and decades past, teams probably would have held on to an asset like Justin Tucker. Now, again, I stand by my point that he was one of the worst kickers in football last year. And the Ravens, who finished with a 12-5 record, if Justin Tucker is making his kicks, they're looking at a 13-4 record and they're fighting for a first seed in the AFC, a first round bye, and home field advantage in the playoffs. Like, that's a really, really big deal. And I think that, again, without the allegations, this would have been a very real conversation, maybe not quite as harsh or as blunt as, hey, we're good, you move on, Justin, we're going to do our thing.
Yeah, the season before he was kicking at nearly 90%.
Yeah.
Right? And last year was 73%.
Exactly.
So it went down a lot.
Yeah, and that's something that I don't want to be ignored by people. And I think when the Ravens come out and say, we did this for football reasons, even if they're not telling the full story of why they cut him, the football part of the story is a massive part of this, and it's something that can't be ignored.
And the wording that they've been using is important to keep in mind. The CBA, the collective bargaining agreement for the players in the NFL, says that the team and the league cannot both penalize a player for the same allegations.
Right? Correct.
So it's going to be one or the other, right? So by the Ravens saying this was a football decision, that leaves an open door for the NFL to say we are going to punish this player for these non-football related allegations.
Sure.
So, I mean, the fact that they've been very careful about their wording, saying this is a football decision, may get them off the hook. It certainly doesn't protect Justin Tucker very much.
Yeah, and also you have to think about it from the perspective of the Baltimore Ravens. If they come out and say the allegations were a big part of why we decided to part ways with Justin, and then if the NFL were to conclude their investigation and say we found no reason to believe there was any wrongdoing, now you have the league and one of their franchises, and currently one of the big franchises in the league, not on the same page about a very controversial and contentious issue. And I personally think that the Ravens handled this correctly. I think that it would have been rather brash and also unfair to the investigation and the due process for Justin Tucker to come out and make the allegations a reason for why he was cut, particularly, and I'll keep saying this till I'm blue in the face, he was costing this team critical games, divisional games. They lost a game to the Philadelphia Eagles that went on to be Super Bowl champions by 5 points. Justin Tucker missed 2 field goals and an extra point. Yeah. If you don't want to do the quick math, that's 7 points, a full touchdown left on the field by the place kicker. I'm sorry, when Lamar Jackson is your MVP quarterback, you got Derrick Henry at 31, 32 years old, rushing for over 1,000 yards in a season. Zay Flowers is a Pro Bowl wide receiver. Isaiah Likely going out and cementing himself as a top 10 tight end in this league alongside Mark Andrews, who struggled but found his way towards the end of the season. You can't have a special teams player deciding these big games for you.
And
the football reasons is legitimate.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see if Justin Tucker's career crashes and burns, because there have been players, Colin Kaepernick, you know, was essentially blackballed from the league for, you know, a controversy that had nothing to do with, you know, sexual impropriety or any of that stuff. Deshaun Watson, his career is done. He's over.
Yeah.
You know, but if another team picks him up, there are people who were reluctant to pick up Colin Kaepernick, who was certainly not past his prime at the time that he got cut by the 49ers. And, you know, If the team makes a decision like they seem to make in the Colin Kaepernick case, that it's bad for business, that it's bad for the image of the team, you know, is hiring Justin Tucker as a kicker? He's going to go to the Hall of Fame. I mean, he was an incredible kicker.
Yeah, best of all time. Yeah, he's the best of all time.
Absolutely. So, you know, will a team make that decision that, oh, this is not going to be good for our image?
And I think that the Deshaun Watson comparison is very apt. Because Deshaun Watson, when he was brought into Cleveland, he was one of the best quarterbacks in the league. I think many people would say he was a top 5 quarterback in the league. And he was so vilified by his own fan base that every time he ran out of the tunnel, there was a cacophony of boos. Every time that he made a good play, there weren't a whole lot of cheers in the stadium. And you can't tell me that that doesn't factor into your gameplay and the psychology that you bring in to a game every week. And for a position like place kicker, which is so mental and so psychological and so clutch, for lack of a better term, I can't imagine being booed when you run out of the tunnel, not being cheered for when you do your job well, especially Justin Tucker, who was someone who was glorified and put up on a pedestal, to go to being, again, vilified. I can't imagine that that's something teams would want to invite into their clubhouse, would want to invite into their stadium. And I just think that fans, you know, the general populace, our perspective on these sexual improprieties is just different. And I think people are more comfortable and more okay with voicing their displeasure with it and voicing their dissatisfaction with it. And I don't think that it will be sweet. I don't think that people will show up to training camp and want to get Justin Tucker's autograph. I don't think moms are going to want to see their sons or daughters run up to Justin after games, before games, at training camp, and take pictures with him and get autographs. It will be a very dark cloud that hangs over teams.
Yeah. Gabe Ortiz is WIPR's afternoon host and a sports aficionado. We're going to take a quick break. And up next, Danielle Allentuck, who covers the Orioles for the Baltimore Banner. She will join Gabe and me here on the other side of a quick break. You are welcome to join us, too. Let's talk O's when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Did Brandon Hyde, the manager who was recently fired by the Orioles, get a raw deal from the team? What do you think? Was that a good move? Was it a neutral move? Was it a useless move? We'd love to hear your thoughts. 410-662-8780 or midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday on Sports. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, John Swow, the new director of the Peale Museum in Baltimore, reflects on his first few months on the job and his vision for the future of America's very first museum. It's right here in Baltimore, the Peale. Plus, we'll have a preview of this month's first Thursday concert with Tyler Laporte of WTMD. That's on the way tomorrow, and if you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Sports.
Something magic happens Every time you go, you make the magic happen. The magic of Orioles baseball.
Yes, Orioles fans are definitely singing a different tune this year than we had expected to sing. After two seasons of dominating the American League East, the Baltimore Orioles are 14 games out of first place and 9 games out of playoff contention, but perhaps the most important number is 11. That's how many players are currently on the injured list at the moment. Colton Cowser was reactivated yesterday. Maybe as stars like Jordan Westberg and Cedric Mullins return to the lineup and our pitching staff gets healthier, our fortunes will improve. Who knows? Let's talk Orioles baseball. Gabe Ortiz is with me here in Studio B. Gabe is WIPR's afternoon host. He's also worked as a statistician for National Sports Broadcast for many years. You can join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. And Danielle Allentuck joins us now. She's a beat reporter who covers the Orioles for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. Hey, Danielle, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
We're doing good.
Doing great, Danielle. Always good to talk to you.
So, Danielle, when Brandon Hyde was let go, what was the mood in the clubhouse? How did you sense the players reacted to that move by Mike Elias and the management of the Orioles?
You know, I think the players were a little bit shocked, honestly. And I think a lot of them felt responsible for Hyde losing his job because, you know, as they said, Hyde lost his job because, you know, them, the players, didn't play well enough to warrant keeping him. So I think a lot of them, you know, felt this really heavy responsibility. Hyde was the only manager that a good portion of that clubhouse knew. So they were really close with him. You know, they've seen him over the years, and you know, a couple of the veteran players were even close to tears. You know, Cedric Mullins was almost crying talking about his relationship with Hyde. So I think they were just really shell-shocked.
Yeah, Danielle, and I want to stick on that for a second, because I feel like when a manager gets fired, the team and the clubhouse usually react in one of two ways. And it's either the way we saw with the Orioles, which was it was kind of like a funeral the day that he got fired, or there's a bit of fire that gets lit underneath the team. And it's this, you know, we're going to go show the world that we're not a team that gets managers fired, that we're a team that can turn this around, and we're a team that deserves to have butts in seats and deserves to be seen as a contender for the playoffs and to be a place that's, you know, vying to win championship titles. And the Orioles did not go in that direction. They lost 6 games in a row after Brandon Hyde got fired. And I'm just curious, as somebody who has boots on the ground, you know, what did you take away from this team, their mentality and their response to Brandon Hyde leaving? And what kind of trajectory do you think that potentially set the team on for the rest of the season?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. It was definitely the first option where, you know, they were really sad about it. They did not light a fire under their butts at all. There were a lot of excuses, to be honest, you know, a lot of blaming on all the injuries that have happened this year, which, you know, has contributed to that record. But the team has also played poorly beyond the injuries. You know, you can't just blame it on that directly. I think the past couple of days, I have noticed a change. I think beating a team 3 in a row, sweeping the White Sox like they did last weekend, did help them a little bit with some of that confidence and some of that morale. But, you know, beating the worst team in the league should definitely not be, you know, the confidence boost that you think it might be. So I think it took them some time to kind of get over themselves, but I think we have seen a little bit of a difference over the past couple of days.
Danielle Allentuck covers the Orioles for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. We'd love to hear what you think about the Orioles' woes this season and how we can turn things around. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. And Danielle, you wrote a really nice profile of Tony Mancelino, the interim head coach, who was brought into the league by Brandon Hyde. So there's a loyalty to Brandon Hyde from the current interim manager. How do you think Tony Mancelino has reacted to, you know, his big break coming the way it has come?
I think Tony Mancelino has been very honest, and that's been very refreshing to hear somebody in a professional sports world be where he has said it. You know, he never wanted this. You know, this was never his goal. It was never to take over for Brandon Hyde. It was never to, you know, have his manager go out like this. But, you know, he's, you know, it's still an opportunity for him to, you know, make a name for himself in this league. So I think he's really, you know, on the staff, he's the best prepared guy that they have. They got rid of all their veteran coaches. And I think he's doing his best. I think he's admitting what he doesn't know. And what he doesn't know is the pitching side of this game. He's never been a pitcher. He's never been a pitching coach. So he's really had to lean on some of the pitching coaches. But what I have found very refreshing is that he's not afraid to admit that he needs help and that he's not an expert in everything and that he needs some of his other coaches to kind of step it up a little bit and fill the gaps of what he doesn't have experience in. So I think he's done okay. I think that the team has not, you know, been drastically different under him, but that's also partly because it's the same players and there's only so much you can do with the same group of guys.
And of course, Gabe, pitching is where this team really needs some help.
Yeah, and I mean, ironically, of all the people this season, we saw Charlie Morton go out at 42 years old and have a couple of really strong outings. But with the current slate of injuries that we have on this team, Danielle, just how significant are getting guys like Zach Eflin healthy? Do we have any update on Grayson Rodriguez, on what his trajectory is? It seems like every new quote we get from management about Grayson Rodriguez, his return seems further and further away. So I'm kind of curious what his trajectory looks like and how Zach Eflin is coming along. I know that he's back pitching for the Orioles, but hasn't quite looked 100% yet. So with those two names, what would you say the status of both of them are?
Grayson Rodriguez has been the great mystery of the season. You know, he gets hurt in spring training. They say, oh, he just needs a cortisone injection. He'll be back in 10 days and then we'll just ramp him up again and he'll be good. That was obviously not the case. The lat injury got worse and then he got an elbow injury and then he was completely shut down. So now he's at least throwing again, but only on flat ground. He has a ways to go. We have not gotten an update from him in a couple weeks. The team is being very, very hush-hush about what's going on. At this point, we don't even know if it's the elbow or the lat that is bothering him. And when it's the lat, there's not even really anything you can do for it besides rest. And if it's the elbow, you start thinking the worst that maybe he needs Tommy John or some other kind of surgery to fix it. So I think
which would be like the 19th player on the team to get Tommy John surgery. Yeah.
Exactly. And we don't know if that's what's going to happen, but obviously something is going on because he has not progressed at all in the past 3 months. So I would be shocked if we see him before August at this point.
And sticking with this story about the long injury list that the Orioles have, we're seeing somebody come off the injury list, which is a very big deal for the Orioles, being Colton Cowser. He looked very good with the Norfolk Tides, a AAA team, during his rehab assignment, hit a single recently, a two-run double, and a stolen base in the same game. I'm curious your perspective of how he's going to bolster this hitting lineup, but I also don't want it to be lost on anybody what he's going to bring to the defensive side of this Orioles team. Is Cedric Mullins being out right now, do we expect Colton Cowser to take that center fielder position on a day-to-day basis? And if so, how important is it that as Cedric leaves the team with an injury, Colton Cowser is going to be able to slot into that center field spot very nicely? And also speak about what he brings for the hitting side of this too.
Yeah, I'm not entirely convinced he's going to bolster this lineup at all. He's definitely shown, you know, at times that he's capable of getting hot and, you know, putting up some good stats. But consistently over his rookie season last year, he was not really able to do that. But where he really shines is his defense. And they really need a strong outfielder right now because four of their top five outfielders are injured. So the fact that he can play center field and that he is almost as good as Cedric Mullins will be huge for this team because they have been playing Jorge Mateo, who's a shortstop, in center field because that's the only option that they have. So in that way, you know, he will be a big addition back tonight.
And Cedric Mullins' injury is considered one that's not going to last too long. I mean, they expect him back in the lineup fairly soon, right? It's a hamstring strain, I guess. You know, so maybe we'll get him sooner rather than later. But Danielle, you've written about this as well. It's not just the injuries. There are some real fundamental baseball that the Orioles have not been executing well. And where do you think that comes from? And is that the kind of thing that Brandon Hyde was lax in addressing, that Tony Mancelino might be better at? This team's making a lot of errors, and they're just not thinking base running, fielding, et cetera.
You're exactly right, especially the base running this past weekend, which is very elementary mistakes, things that you would expect to happen in Little League, not from Major League Baseball players. I think Tony Mancelino's advantage over Brandon Hyde is that he was an infield coordinator for so long, so he can help out with that infield defense. He's a keener eye for that. And he was also a third base coach for a while, so he can help out with the base running while Brandon Hyde's specialty coming up was catching. So he does have a little bit broader of a spear there to help out, but I mean, I truly think that they are just not thinking. You know, they're pressing a lot. They're trying way too hard to win instead of just going out there and playing baseball. And I think that you see them putting a lot of pressure on themselves, and you see them making these mistakes that they probably haven't made in years at this point.
Let's listen to a little bit of what Mike Elias had to say when he was talking about the decision to replace Brandon Hyde with Tony Mancelino.
You know, there come times where the go forward look at things involve different voice and a head coaching change to receive that voice. And, you know, ultimately stretching back into early last summer, this is a team that we feel has been collectively and individually to varying degrees underperforming its talent level. And we want something new in order to hopefully restore them to the level of play that we expect of ourselves.
That right there was general manager of the Baltimore Orioles, Mike Elias, talking about firing manager Brandon Hyde from the Orioles not too long ago. And Danielle, we're speaking with Danielle Allentuck, beat reporter for the Baltimore Banner on the Orioles. I have a little bit of a conspiracy theory here, Danielle, so just bear with me for a second, okay?
He's good at these,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah. I wish we had some X-Files music or something to play right now. But typically when a big move like this happens, like firing a manager, particularly for a team with a lot of great players and a great recent history like the Baltimore Orioles, you hear from the general manager pretty quickly after something like that happens. And yet, Mike Elias, we didn't hear from him other than the prepared statement that they put out alongside the notice that they were parting ways with Brandon Hyde. Is it possible that the decision to fire Brandon Hyde was not Mike Elias's and potentially came from higher up than the general manager seat, maybe even the owner, David Rubenstein? Is it possible that Mike Elias didn't really want to make this move at this time, but was urged on by people with powers greater than his?
I'm really sorry, but I do not think that's the least bit possible. Mike Elias makes the baseball decisions. The ownership is not that closely involved. I think that it was the PR staff that told Mike Elias not to talk right away.
Interesting.
And they did it in Milwaukee, which is a city that has no national baseball writers, has very limited TV coverage, and the traveling party for the Orioles, that beat that travels, majority of it either works for the team via Masson, works for MLB.com, or works for a blog that doesn't criticize the team. So you have three out of your five writers there who are not really going to criticize the team. So it made it, you know, a lot easier for him to face the media when you don't have these national reporters there. You don't have the local TV. You don't have your full extent of the beat there. So I think it was very strategic to have him wait.
And Danielle, just to confirm, you don't buy Gabe's conspiracy theory, but you can confirm that Elvis Presley is alive and lives in Grand Rapids, Michigan, right? I just want to confirm that.
I'm not an expert on that, so I will stay out of this.
Give me something to hold my head high about that I talk about in the office and the station here, Danielle, something.
So, Danielle, what's Mike Elias's future with the team? Anybody talking about a change in that position? Because, you know, people were very, very complimentary of the way he built the team back, you know, but we had some very lean years that we suffered through during the build back years. Then these two amazing seasons, 101 games in one of them, and making to the playoffs 2 years in a row, not doing very well in the playoffs. And then in the offseason this year, you know, we end up with a 42 30-year-old pitcher who had a very rough time the first several outings that he made this season. As Gabe mentioned, he had two much better outings in just last week. So what's your take on Mike Elias's future?
I think his future is not secure, but I think he can save his job at the trade deadline. I think if the Orioles are anywhere close to contention, and by that I mean like 5 to 6 games out of the third wild card spot, and he goes out and he supplements his roster at the deadline, he goes out and get that star pitcher that he should have gotten in the offseason. He gets a couple hitters. If he does what he needs to do to help this team advance and even get close to the playoffs, I think he can save his job. I think if he goes out and he's cheap and he maybe trades away a star and tries to do another rebuild, I would think that his job is on the line.
Danielle Allentuck covers the Orioles for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. Thanks, Danielle. Much appreciated, as always.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have more Midday on Sports with Gabe Ortiz. I'm Tom Hall. We're here in Studio B. We'd love to have you join us, 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Let us know your take on the Ravens, on the Orioles, on the WNBA. What do you think about the Indianapolis-Oklahoma matchup in the NBA Finals? That begins on Thursday night. 410-662-8780. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you just joined us, it's Midday on Sports. Gabe Ortiz is with me here in Studio B. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. A couple of weeks ago, the Baltimore Banner had a headline that streamed across my phone after they had lost 8 games. It said, breaking news, Baltimore Orioles win a baseball game. Here was the scene at Camden Yards on Sunday afternoon.
And the Orioles are one out away from a 3-game sweep. The 0-2 pitch, a swing and a miss, and the Orioles collect a 3-game sweep of the Chicago White Sox.
Just like the old days, eh, Gabe? What do you think?
I mean, it's fun to see him win. And, you know, we were talking with Danielle last segment about the fact that they swept the White Sox. And, you know, it's not exactly a Herculean effort to beat one of the worst teams in baseball, but it is their first sweep of the season. And sometimes you just need those milestones.
And the last couple of years, we got used to sweeps all the time.
And I think when you're in, you know, this tragic slump, like your somber music coming into last segment suggested about the Orioles, you need those things just to hang your hat on something. You know, it's like if you're having a bad run at work, 2 bad weeks at work, you have that one good day and it reminds you why you come into the office every day. It reminds you that you can do this job and that, you know, you are worthy of being here. And these are professional baseball players, but they're also very young professional baseball players, by and large, in this clubhouse. And I think that those things are going to be important for them to say, hey, we threw together a winning streak. Hey, we swept a team at home. And now they're heading to the Northwest for this next series against the Seattle Mariners, which is going to be a much tougher task than the Chicago White Sox were. But they're going to go into that with a bit more juice, I feel like.
And a little jet lag.
You know, and a little jet lag, which
starts at 9:40 Eastern time.
So Tom is going to be asleep by the second inning. But don't worry, folks. I'll be watching the full game. So when we hop on here again, I can give you the report. But
some of it is just so hard to watch, too. You have a player like Adley Rutschman.
Yeah.
You know, who had these amazing seasons, all-star catcher, could hit from both sides, still can.
Yeah.
But, boy, he's just struggled so much. And there are people saying, you know, he shouldn't be batting number 2. He should be batting number 8.
Yeah.
And those kinds of conversations you just couldn't have imagined 2 years ago.
And I also think, you know, and while it's not quite as bad as Adley has been, Gunnar Henderson, who was supposed to be the face of this franchise, the year-in, year-out MVP candidate, is also not playing up to his standard right now. But when you look at these guys, it goes back to my former point of sometimes they just need to prove to themselves again that they can do it. Many of these young players are for the first time in their lives facing a slump like this. I mean, we are talking about players who, from T-ball,
since little league, high school, college,
and then through this hot start they've all had together as a young core with the Orioles, have been the best players at their position or one of the best players in their position. And for the first time in their young lives, they are facing the fact that maybe I'm not all I thought I was. And the only way that you can break out of that is by doing the dang thing. And I think this run of games that they've had, particularly coming out of the, for lack of a better term, Hyde funeral that took place after he got fired in the six subsequent games afterwards, it seems like they're kind of coming out of that. And I think that there was an era of this team from the second half of last year leading up to Brandon Hyde being fired and the fallout from that, that this team needed to evolve from that. They needed to say, that's not who we are anymore. And Hyde being fired was part of that. Them going through the grief of him being fired, which, again, I keep using this funeral analogy because that is what it felt like. Cedric Mullins, the veteran leader of this team, was holding back tears talking about this guy getting fired. That is not something you see in sports very often. And maybe it's a good thing that, you know, we see a bit more of that vulnerability from pro athletes. But these are the most macho guys you're going to find. And for them to be publicly holding back tears and you know, borderline weeping over this guy just losing his job, which is a big deal, don't get me wrong, but there was no death in the family. You know, there was no real tragedy. This is something that happens in the business of baseball. They took it very hard. And I think what we've seen with these wins and these performances from players who we were not expecting from, like Charlie Morton on the mound, I think that they're coming out of this a little bit. And does it mean they're going to save the season? No. They're 9 games back from a playoff spot, which is a mountain to climb, but not quite Everest. And they're winning games again. And it's kind of fun to tune into the Orioles. I watch a lot of Orioles games. I talked about them a lot at my last job at a different station here in Baltimore. And I was dreading watching Orioles games.
Dude,
for quite some time.
This season, you got a perverse notion of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, sometimes they can't even run the bases. They look like little league teams.
It's
rough.
It drives
you nuts sometimes.
But the past week or so, I've tuned in and
true.
I said, well, let's see what they're going to do today. And for a long time, it wasn't, let's see what they're going to do today. It was, when are they going to lose?
Yeah.
And when am I going to turn this
off?
How
long will it take?
You know, when am I going to flip over to Netflix? Mm-hmm. And now it's like, well, let's see what they do. And that's how it starts. And I'm not trying to take any kind of victory lap or plant a flag, because this team could fall apart for the next 3 months and, you know, we could be picking in the top three of the draft next season. But if it is going to happen, this is how it starts. And to your point about Adley Rutschman not hitting very well and Gunnar Henderson not hitting very well, and obviously Colton Cowser and Jordan Westberg have been hurt, who's the most improved hitter from last season to this season?
Jackson Holliday.
And Jackson Holliday's personal hitting coach is his father, Matt Holliday, who was a big leaguer for a long time in his own right. The Orioles just recently hired, in the wake of firing Brandon Hyde, John Mabry. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. John Mabry, who was Matt Holliday's hitting coach when he was in the league. I think that is far more significant than anybody really realizes. And if we had some more time, I would have liked to ask Danielle about that. As somebody who is in and around the clubhouse, I think that's going to be a big deal. I think that what we have seen Matt Holliday offer to his son Jackson is something that is very applicable to many different players on this team. And I think bringing in somebody that Matt learned his trade from in the big leagues is going to have a big impact on this team. And it's something I'm very excited to see. And I think we're already starting. He hasn't been there very long. It's only been a couple weeks. But we're starting to see these guys kind of pick their heads up a little bit. And we're starting to see guys like Ramon Urias. We're starting to see guys who, unfortunately, he's hurt right now. But Loreno, start to put the ball in play and start to get some runs for this team. And I'm very curious to see how they look against the Seattle Mariners. I need to see some juice and some fire coming
against
out of
a good
this team.
Against
a good team. Yeah. Like make them fight for it, you know?
Exactly. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our program director, Jonathan Blakely, wants to remind us that the Detroit Tigers, his team, are the best team in baseball right now. Let's go back to talk a little bit about the Ravens,
yeah.
Because when it comes to fundamentals, when it comes to the basics of the game, which seems to be a deficit right now in the Orioles, we have Lamar Jackson,
yeah.
Two-time MVP, who is at what we call OTAs. They start today, I think, actually, up in Owings Mills. This is the time of the season that the veteran players often don't appear, but there's Lamar. He's going to practice with the team here in June. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and I think Lamar has gained a lot of notoriety over his career thus far for not showing up to these optional training activities. And I think that it was largely undeserved. I don't think that a quarterback the caliber of Lamar Jackson's season is going to be decided over whether he was running drills with the team in the first week of June. But it is a symbolic thing, I think, for a star quarterback to show up.
And the team just re-signed or extended Derrick Henry,
who had an amazing season last year. And Derrick Henry is also in attendance, another player who I think most people would not really expect to show up in June to do team workouts and would be working with their own personal trainers or maybe having a few extra days in Cancun, you know, before they really lock in for training camp. And I think that you can take a lot away from this symbolically, that this team understands the moment that they're in right now. And I think you see the Kansas City Chiefs, obviously they won in the AFC, but got quite ran over literally and figuratively by the Philadelphia Eagles in the Super Bowl. I think that a lot of teams in the AFC, particularly these top teams, the Baltimore Ravens, the Buffalo Bills, are seeing that the throne is open right now in the American Football Conference. And I think that they realize that there is a time and place to snatch the throne away, and that is right now. And that window gets smaller and smaller every single year. So I look at this as Lamar and Derrick Henry by extension saying, you know, let's lock in. Let's do this thing. Let's finally do this thing. And I'm a believer that once the floodgates open, they open. It took Peyton Manning a very, very long time to win his first Super Bowl. If you put Lamar and Peyton Manning's career right up against each other, this would be the year Peyton Manning won his first Super Bowl. Just to, not to say Lamar will because Peyton did, but just to put into perspective that not every quarterback is Tom Brady. It
doesn't happen overnight.
Not every quarterback is Patrick Mahomes. Those are outliers in this. And to
you have a player like, you know, Odafe Owe.
Sure.
Who's put on 20 pounds and seems to have a renewed vigor or a new fire in the belly to make the Pro Bowl and to make a real difference. Now, I've put on 20 pounds, too. I don't know if that's going to help the Ravens. But, you know, it's really it's a good thing to see players saying, OK, we're going to do what it takes.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that, you know, obviously we talked about in our first segment for people who missed it with Kyle Goon of the Baltimore Banner talking about this whole Justin Tucker thing. And I think that a positive that can come out of that very ugly situation is the team rallying around a little bit and saying, you know, hey, let's make this about football. Let's control what we can control in the building. And that is doing the extra things like, you know, staying in the gym for a couple extra hours like Odafe Owe is, like Lamar coming back from vacation a little bit earlier to be at OTAs, Derrick Henry being 32 years old and just signing a big money contract with the Ravens and still saying, I'm going to show up with the young guys and I'm going to work and I'm going to lead. And that's what I'm seeing from this team right now. It's as encouraging of a start to the summer as you could hope from an NFL team that is in Super Bowl contention just about every year for the past decade or so. So I'm very encouraged by it. And I think Baltimore Ravens fans should be too.
Gabe Ortiz, he was a contestant on Survivor 47. He's WIPR's afternoon host, and he's a resident sports guru here at WIPR. Always good to see you, sir. Thank you very much. Talk to you soon. And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on the Arts. I'll have a conversation with John Swow, the director of the Peale Museum in Baltimore, and Tyler Laporte of WTMD. He's going to give us a preview of this week's First Thursday concert in Canton. Up next, it's Fresh Air. The actor Mark Hamill is the guest today. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.